Chapter 17. Oh, my heaven, Tom, the fun we had. The glorious freewheeling last honeymoon, even as the clouds gathered. You would be pardoned for thinking that the duties of a deputy head of station, though elevated, are inferior to those of his boss. Not so. The head of station in Washington floats in the upper air of intelligence diplomacy. His task is to massage the corpse of the special relationship and convince everybody, including himself, that it is alive and well. Every morning, poor Hal Tressider rose early, put on his old Shibernian tie and sweat-patched tropical suit, and pedalled his pushbike earnestly away to the sodden dreamland of the committee rooms, leaving your father free to ransack the station registry, supervise the outstations in San Francisco, Boston, and Chicago, or dart off to welfare a field agent in transit to Central America, China, or Japan. Another chore was shepherding grey-faced British boffins through the battery farms of American high technology, where the scientific secrets that are traded in Washington have their artificial conception. Dining the poor souls, Tom, while others would have left them mouldering in their motels, consoling them in their womanless, underfinanced foreign exile, chatting hastily memorized jargon at them about nose cones, turning radius, underwater communication, and captive carry, borrowing their working documents from them to give back in the morning. Hello, that looks interesting. Mind if I sneak a sight of that for our naval attaché? He's been badgering the Pentagon about that one for years, but they've been holding out on him. The naval attaché had a sight. London had a sight. Prague had a sight. For what use is a cosmic pass without a cosmic readership? Poor, stolid, worthy Hal, how meticulously Pym misused your trust and torpedoed your innocent ambitions. Never mind, if the National Trust won't have you, you can always count on the Royal Automobile Club or a favoured city company. I say, Pimmy, there's some ghastly group of physicists visiting the Livermore Weapons Laboratory next month, you would say, all apology and diffidence. You don't think you could pop down there and feed and water a few of them and see they don't blow their noses on the tablecloth, could you? Why on earth this service has to behave like a lot of flat-footed security officers these days, I really don't know. I've a good mind to do a letter to London about it, if I can squeeze a moment. No country was ever easier to spy on, Tom. No nation so open-hearted with its secrets, so quick to air them, share them, confide them, or consign them too early to the junk heap of planned American obsolescence. I am too young to know whether there was a time when Americans were able to restrain their admirable passion to communicate, but I doubt it. Certainly the path has been downhill since 1945, for it was quickly apparent that information which 10 years ago would have cost Axel's service thousands of dollars in precious hard currency could by the mid-70s be had for a few coppers from the Washington Post. We could have resented this sometimes if we had been smaller natures, for there are few things more vexing in the spy world than landing a great scoop for Prague and London one week, only to read the same material in Aviation Weekly the next. But we did not complain. In the great fruit garden of American technology, there were pickings enough for everyone, and none of us need ever want for anything again. Cameos, Tom. Little tiles for your mosaic are all I need to give you now. See the two friends romping under a darkening sky, catching the last rays of the sunlight before the game is over. See them thieving like children, knowing the police are round the corner. Pym did not take to America in a night, not in a month, for all the splendid fireworks of the 4th. His love of the place grew with Axel's. Without Axel, he might never have seen the light. Pym set out, believe it or not, determined to disapprove of everything he saw. This world was too young for him, too wanting in authority. He found no holding point, no stern judgment to revolt against. These vulgar, pleasure-seeking people, so frank and clamorous, were too uninhibited for his shielded and involuted life. They loved their prosperity too obviously, were too flexible and mobile, too little the slaves of place, origin, and class. They had no sense of that hush which all Pym's life had been the background music of his inhibition. In committee, it was true, they reverted soon enough to type, and became the warring princelings of the European countries they had left behind. They could run you up a cabal that would make medieval Venice blush. They could be Dutch and stubborn, Scandinavian and gloomy, Balkan and murderous and tribal. But when they mixed with one another, they were American and loquacious and disarming, and Pym was hard put to find a centre to betray. Why had they done him no harm? Why had they not cramped him, frightened him, forced his limbs into impossible positions from the cradle up? He found himself longing for the empty, darkened streets of Prague and the reassuring embrace of chains. He wanted his dreadful schools back. He wanted anything but the marvellous horizons that led to lives he had not lived. He wanted to spy upon hope itself, look through keyholes at the sunrise, and deny the possibilities he had missed. And all this time, ironically, Europe was coming to get him. He knew that. So did Axel. Not a year had passed before the first insidious whispers of suspicion began to reach their ears. Yet it was this very intimation of mortality that shook Pym out of his reluctance and inspired him to take the upper hand in their relationship, just as Axel was saying, "End it. Get out." A mysterious gratitude for America the Just and her impending retribution seized him as, like a ponderous puzzled giant, she bore steadily down on him, clutching in her great soft fist the multiplying evidence of his duplicity. "Certain aristos in Langley and London are getting worried about our Cheko networks, Sir Magnus," Axel warned him, in his stiff, dry English, at a crash meeting in the car park of the Robert F. Kennedy Stadium. "They have begun to discern unfortunate patterns." "What patterns? There are no patterns." "They have noticed that the Cheko networks provide better intelligence when we are running them, and almost nothing when we are not. That is the pattern. They have computers these days. It takes them 5 minutes to turn everything upside down and wonder what is the right way up." "We have been careless, Sir Magnus. We were too greedy. Our parents were right. If you want a thing done well, you must do it yourself."
"Jack Brotherhood can run those networks as well as we can. The head agents are genuine. They report whatever they can get hold of. All networks go moribund now and then. It's normal."
"These networks only go moribund when we are not there, Sir Magnus," Axel repeated patiently. "That is Langley's perception. It bothers them."
"Then give the networks better material. Signal Prague. Tell your aristos we need a scoop."
Axel sadly shook his head. "You know Prague, Sir Magnus. You know my aristos. The man who is absent is the man they conspire against. I have no power to persuade them."
Calmly, Pym contemplated the option that remained to him. Over dinner in their smart house in Georgetown, while Mary played gracious hostess, gracious English lady, gracious diplomatic geisha, Pym wondered whether it was time to persuade Poppy to cross one more frontier after all. He saw himself free of taint, a husband, son and father, in good standing at last. He remembered an old revolutionary farmhouse he and Poppy had admired in Pennsylvania, set among rolling fields and stone fences, with thoroughbred horses that loomed at them out of the sun-stained morning fog. He remembered the whitewashed churches, so sparkling and hopeful after the musty crypts of his childhood, and imagined the resettled family Pym at work and prayer there, and Axel rocking on the garden swing while he drank vodka and shelled peas for lunch. "I shall sell Axel to Langley and buy my freedom," he thought, as he dazzled a pearly-toothed matron with a witty anecdote. "I shall negotiate an administrative amnesty for myself and put the record straight." He never did. He never would. Axel was his keeper and his virtue. He was the altar on which Pym had laid his secrets and his life. He had become the part of Pym that was not owned by anybody else. "Do I need to tell you, Tom, how bright and dear the world looks when we know our days are numbered? How all life swells and opens to you, and says, 'Come in,' just when you had thought you were unwanted? What a paradise America became once Pym knew the writing was on the wall, all his childhood rushing back to him. He took Mary to points at Winterthur in the Chateau country, and dreamed of Switzerland and Ascot. He wandered Georgetown's beautiful Oak Hill Cemetery, and imagined he was with Dorothy at the Glades, confined to the dripping orchard, where his guilty face could be hidden from the passers-by. Minnie Wilson was our letterbox at Oak Hill, Tom. Our first in all America. Go and take a look at her one day. She lies on a curled plinth a short way down the terraced bowl, a small dead Victorian girl in marble drapes. We left our messages in a leafy recess between Minnie's backside and her protector, one Thomas Entwistle, who had died in later age. The doyen of the graveyard rested higher up, near the gravel sweep where Pym parked his diplomatic car. Axel found him. Axel made sure Pym found him, too. He was Stefan Osuski, co-founder of the Czechoslovak Republic, died in exile, 1973. No concealed offering to Axel seemed complete without a silent prayer of greeting to our brother Stefan. After Minnie, as the volume of our business grew, we were obliged to appoint postmen nearer to the centre of the town. We selected forgotten bronze generals, mostly French, who had fought on the American side in order to annoy the British. We relished their soft hats and telescopes and horses, and the flowers in red uniform at their feet. Their battlefields were grey squares filled with lounging students. Our letterboxes, anything from the stubby cannon that protected them, to the stunted conifers, whose inner branches made convenient brown nests of pine needles. But Axel's favourite place of all was the newly opened National Air and Space Museum, where he could gaze his heart out at the Spirit of St. Louis and John Glenn's Friendship 7, and touch the moon relic with his forefinger, as devoutly as if he were taking water from a holy shrine. Pym never saw him do these things. He could only hear about them afterwards. The trick was to leave their packages in separate lockers in the cloakroom, and swap keys in the darkness of the Samuel P. Langley projection theatre, while the audience gasped and clutched the handrails as the screen dazzled them with the thrills of flight. And away from the eyes and ears of Washington, Tom? What shall I give you first? Silicon Valley, perhaps, and the little Spanish village south of San Francisco, where Murgo's monks sang plain song to us after dinner. Or the Dead Sea landscape of Palm Springs, where the golf carts had Rolls-Royce grills, and the mountains of Moab looked down on the pastel stucco and artificial rock pools of our walled motel, while illegal Mexicans wandered the lawns with backpacks, blowing away unsightly leaves that could offend the sensibilities of our fellow millionaires. Can you imagine Axel's ecstasy as he beheld the outdoor air conditioning machines that moistened the desert air and blew micro-mist over the sunbathers with faces covered in green mud? And shall I tell you of the Palm Springs Humane Society's dog adoption dinner we attended to celebrate Pym's acquisition of the very latest blueprint for the nose cone of the stealth bomber? How the dogs were led on stage, groomed and ribboned, to be fostered out to humane ladies, while everybody wept as if they were Vietnamese orphans. Of the all-day Bible Thumpers radio channel that portrayed the Christian God as the champion of wealth, since wealth was the enemy of communism. God's waiting room is what they call Palm Springs. It has one swimming pool for every 5 inhabitants, and lies a couple of hours' drive from the biggest killing factories in the world. Its industries are charity and death. That night, unknown to the retired bandits and senile comedians who made up its geriatric court, Pym and Axel added espionage to the list of its accomplishments. "We shall never fly so high again, Sir Magnus," Axel said, as he reverently surveyed Pym's offering in the silence of their $600-a-night suite. "I think we may retire also. Shall I give you Disneyland and another projection room, with a circular screen that showed us the American dream? Can I convince you that Pym and Axel wept sincere tears as they watched the refugees from European persecution set foot on American soil, while the commentator spoke of a nation of nations and the land of the free? We believed it, Tom." And Pym believes it still. Pym never felt more free in his life until the night Rick died. Everything he still contrived to love in himself was here to love in the people around him, a willingness to open themselves to strangers, a guile that was only there to protect their innocence, a fantasy that fired but never owned them, a capacity to be swayed by everything while still remaining sovereign. And Axel loved them too, but he was not so confident that his affection was reciprocated. "Wexler is setting up an investigation team, Sir Magnus," he warned one night in Boston, as they dined in the colonial dignity of the Ritz Hotel. "Some bad defector has been telling stories. It's time we got out." Pym said nothing at all. They walked through the park and watched the swan boats on the pond. They sat in a tense, bare Irish pub that seethed with crimes the English had forgotten. But Pym still refused to speak. A few days later, however, visiting an English don at Yale who occasionally supplied the firm with tidbits, he found himself in front of the effigy of the American hero Nathan Hale, who was hanged by the British as a spy. His hands were bound behind his back. Below him were inscribed his last words: "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." For several weeks after this, Pym went to ground. Pym was talking. Pym was on the move. Pym was somewhere in the room, arms locked at his sides, palms splayed like someone wishing to fly or swim. He was sinking into his knees, rolling his shoulders against the wall. He was clutching the green cabinet and shaking it, and the cabinet was hobbling in his grasp like an old grandfather clock about to flatten him with its embrace, and the burn box was bobbing and swaying on top of it, saying, "Take me." He was swearing, all in his head. He was talking, all in his head. He wanted calm from his surroundings, but they wouldn't give it him. He was at his desk again, and the sweat was patting on the paper around him. He was writing. He was calm, but the damned room still wouldn't settle. It was interfering with his prose. Boston again. Pym has been visiting the golden semicircle that lies along Route 128. Welcome to America's technological highway. It is a place like a crematorium without a smokestack. Discreet, low-lying factories and laboratories crouch amid shrubberies and landscaped mounds. He has picked the brains of a British delegation and taken a few forbidden photographs with a concealed camera in his briefcase. He has lunched privately at the home of a great American patriarch of industry named Bob, whom he has befriended for his indiscretion. They have sat on the veranda. They have gazed across a garden of descending lawns, which a black man is sedately mowing with a triple cutter. After lunch, Pym drives to Needham, where Axel is waiting for him beside a bend in the Charles River, which serves them as their local Aare. A heron skims over the blue-green rushes. Red-tailed hawks eye them from dead trees. Their path climbs deep into the woods, along a raised esker. "So what's the matter?" says Axel, finally. "Why should anything be the matter? You are tense and you are not speaking. It is reasonable to assume something is the matter." "I'm always tense for a debriefing." "Not tense like this." "He wouldn't talk to me." "Bob wouldn't?" "I asked him how the Nimitz refitting contract was going. He replied that his corporation was making great strides in Saudi Arabia. I asked him about his discussions with the Admiral of the Pacific Fleet. He asked me when I was going to bring Mary up to Maine for the weekend. His face has changed." "How?" "He's angry. Somebody's warned him about me. I think he's more angry with them than he is with me." "What else?" says Axel patiently, knowing that with Pym there is always one more door. "I was followed to his house. A green Ford, smoked windows. There's nowhere to hang around, and American watchers don't walk. So they left again." "What else?" "Stop asking what else. What else?" Suddenly a great gulf of caution and mistrust separated them. "Axel," said Pym, finally. It was unusual for Pym to address him by name. The proprieties of espionage normally restrained him. "Yes, Sir Magnus." "When we were in Bern together, when we were students." "You weren't, were you?" "Not a student." "You weren't spying on anyone? On the Ollingers, on the Cosmo, on me?" You hadn't got people running you in those days. You were just you. I was not spying. Nobody was running me. Nobody owned me. Is that true? But Pym knew already that it was. He knew it by the rare glow of anger that shone in Axel's eyes, by the solemnity and distaste in his voice. It was your idea that I was a spy, Submagnus. It was never mine. Pym watched him light a fresh cigar and noticed how the flame of the match trembled. It was Jack Brotherhood's idea, Pym corrected him. Axel drew on his cigar, and his shoulders slowly relaxed. It doesn't matter, he said. It is simply unimportant at our age. Bose authorized a hostile interrogation, said Pym. I'm flying back to London on Sunday to face the music. Who should talk to Axel of interrogation, and of a hostile one at that? Who should dare compare the nocturnal posturings of a couple of the firm's tame barristers in a safe house in Sussex with the beatings and electric shocks and deprivations that for two decades had been Axel's irregular fare? I blush now to think I used the word to him at all. In 52, as I learned later, Axel had denounced Slansky and demanded the death sentence for him. Not very loud, because he was half dead himself. But that's terrible, Pym had cried. How can you serve a country that does that to you? It was not terrible at all, thank you. I should have done it earlier. I secured my survival, and Slansky would have died whether I denounced him or not. Give me another vodka. In 56, he went down again. That time it was less problematic, he explained, lighting himself a fresh cigar. I denounced Tito, and nobody even bothered to go and kill him. In the early 60s, while Pym was in Berlin, Axel had rotted for 3 months in a medieval dungeon outside Prague. What he promised that time has always been unclear to me. It was the year when the Stalinists themselves were purged, if only half-heartedly, and Slansky was declared alive again, if only posthumously, though he was still ruled to be guilty of his offences, you will remember, if only innocently. In any case, Axel came back looking 10 years older, and for some months had a soft R in his speech that was very like a stammer. Beside experience like this, the Inquisition of Pym was watery stuff indeed. Jack Brotherhood was there to defend him. Personnel fussed over him like an old hen, assuring him it was just a matter of answering a few questions. Some chinless flunky from Treasury kept warning my persecutors they were in danger of exceeding their brief, and my two jailers insisted on talking to me about their children. After 5 days and nights of it, Pym felt as spry as if he had been taking a country holiday, and his interrogators were out on their feet. "Good trip, darling?" Mary asked, back in Georgetown, after a morning in bed in which Pym had temporarily slaked the tension. "Great," said Pym. "And Jack sends love." But on his walk to the embassy, he saw a new white arrow chalked on the brickwork of the Fair Deal wine shop, which was Axel's warning to attempt no contact until further notice. And here, Tom, it is time for me to tell you what Rick was doing. For your grandfather had one last trick to play before the end. It was his best, as you would suppose. Rick shrank. He abandoned monstrosity as a way of life, and came weeping and cringing to me like a whipped animal. And the smaller and more encompassable he became, the less secure Pym felt. It was as if the firm and Rick were closing in on him from either side, each with his regretful hangdog banality, and Pym, like an acrobat on the high wire between them, suddenly had nothing to support him. Pym implored him in his mind. He screamed at him, "Stay bad, stay monstrous, keep your distance, don't give up." But on Rick came, shuffling and smirking like a pauper, knowing his power was greatest now that he was weak. "I did it all for you, son. It's thanks to me you've taken your place among the highest in the land. Got a few coppers for your old man, have you? How about a nice mixed grill, or are you ashamed to take your old pal out?" He struck first one Christmas day, not 6 weeks after Pym had received a formal apology from head office. Georgetown had 2 feet of snow, and we had asked the letterers to lunch. Mary was putting the food on the table as the phone rang. Will Ambassador Pym accept a collect call from New Jersey? He will.
Hello, old son. How's the world using you?
I'll take this upstairs, says Pym grimly to Mary, and everybody looks understanding, knowing that the secret world never sleeps.
Happy Christmas, old son, says Rick, as Pym picks up the bedroom phone.
And happy Christmas to you too, father. What are you doing in New Jersey?
God's the 12th man on the cricket team, son. It's God who tells us to keep the left elbow up through life, no one else.
So you always said. But it's not the cricket season.
Are you drunk?
He's umpire, judge and jury rolled into one, and never you forget it. There's no conning God, there never was.
Are you glad I paid for your education, then?
I'm not conning God, father. I'm trying to celebrate with my family.
Say hello to Miriam, says Rick.
And there is muffled protest before Miriam comes on the line.
Hello, Magnus, says Miriam.
Hello, Miriam, says Pym.
Hello,
says Miriam a second time.
They feed you all right in that embassy of yours, son, or is it all Thousand Island and French fries?
We have a perfectly decent canteen for the lower staff, but at the moment I'm trying to eat at home.
Turkey?
Yes.
English bread sauce?
I expect so.
That grandson of mine all right, then, is he? He's got the forehead, has he? The one I gave you that everybody talks about.
He's got a very good brow.
Blue eyes, same as mine.
Mary's eyes.
I hear she's first class, son. I hear first-rate reports of her. They say she's got a fine piece of property down in Dorset that's worth a bob or two.
It's in trust, says Pym, sharply.
But Rick has already begun drowning in the gulf of his own self-pity.
He weeps. The weep becomes a howl.
In the background, Miriam is weeping too, in a high-pitched whimper, like a small dog locked in a big house.
But darling, says Mary, as Pym resumes his place as head of the family.
Magnus, you're upset. What's the matter?
Pym shakes his head, smiling and crying at once. He grabs his wine glass and lifts it.
To absent friends, he calls out.
To all our absent friends. And later, for a wife's ears only. Just an old, old Joe, darling, who managed to track me down and wish me a happy bloody Yule.
Would you ever have supposed, Tom, that the greatest country in the world could be too small for one son and his old man?
Yet that is what happened.
That Rick should head for wherever he could use his son's protection was, I suppose, only natural, and after Berlin, probably inevitable. He went first, as I now know, to Canada, unwisely trusting in the bonds of Commonwealth. The Canadians quickly tired of him, and when they threatened to repatriate him, he made a small down payment on a Cadillac and headed south. In Chicago, my inquiries show that he succumbed to the many enticing offers from property companies to move into new developments on the edge of town and live rent-free for 3 months as an inducement. A Colonel Hanbury resided at Fairview Gardens. A Sir William Forsyth graced Sunley Court, where he extended his tenancy by conducting protracted negotiations to buy the penthouse for his butler. What either of them did for liquidity is, as ever, a mystery, though no doubt there were grateful lovelies in the background. The one clue is a prickly letter from the stewards of a local turf club, advising Sir William that his horses will be welcome when his stable fees have been settled. Pym was still only vaguely aware of these distant rumblings, and his absences from Washington gave him a false sense of protection. But in New Jersey, something changed Rick forever, and whatever it was, from then on, Pym became his only industry. Was the same wind of reckoning blowing over both men simultaneously? Was Rick really ill, or was he like Pym, merely conscious of impending judgment? Certainly Rick thought he was ill. Certainly Rick thought he ought to be. Am obliged to use strong walking stick, $29 cash, at all times owing to heart and other more sinister ailments, he wrote. My doctor keeps the worst from me and recommends that frugal diet,
plain foods and champagne only, no Californian, could prolong this meagre existence, and enable me to fight back for a few more months before I am called. Certainly he took to wearing liver-coloured spectacles like Aunt Nell. And when he fell foul of the law in Denver, the prison doctor was so impressed by him that he was released the moment Pym had paid the medical fees. And after Denver you decided you were already dead, didn't you? And set out to haunt me with your smallness. Every town I went to, I walked in fear of your pathetic ghost. Every safe house I left or entered, I expected to see you waiting at the gate, parading your willed, deliberate littleness. You knew where I would be before I got there. You would con a ticket and travel 5,000 miles just to show me how small you had become. And off we'd go to the best restaurant in town, and I would buy you your treat, and boast to you about my diplomatic doings, and listen to your boastings in return. I would shower you with all the money I could afford, praying that it would enable you to add a few more Wentworths to the green cabinet. But even while I fawned on you and exchanged radiant smiles with you and held hands with you and bolstered you in your idiotic schemes, I knew that you had pulled the best con of them all. You were nothing anymore. Your mantle had passed to me, leaving you a naked little man, and myself the biggest con I knew. Why don't those fellows give you your knighthood then, old son? They tell me you ought to be permanent undersecretary by now. Got a skeleton in your cupboard, have you? Maybe I should slip over to London and have a word with those personnel boys of yours. How did he find me? How could it be that his systems of intelligence were better than those of the agency's leash dogs, who were fast becoming my regular unwelcome companions? At first I thought he was using private detectives. I began collecting the numbers of suspicious cars, noting the times of dead-end phone calls, trying to distinguish them from Langley's. I bearded my secretary. Has someone calling himself my sick father been pestering you for information? Eventually I discovered that the embassy travel clerk had an addiction to playing English snooker at some Masonic hostel in the dirty part of town. Rick had found him there and pitched him a fatuous cover story. "I've got this dicky heart," he'd said to the fool. "It could get me any time, you see, but don't you go telling my boy. I don't like to bother him when he's got enough on his plate as it is. What you're to do, you're to get on the blower to me and give me the wink whenever that boy of mine leaves town, so that I know where to find him when the end comes." And no doubt there was a gold watch in it somewhere, and tickets for next year's cup final. And seeing the boy's dear old mother right next time Rick slipped home for a drop of English air. But my discovery came too late. We had had San Francisco by then, and Denver, and Seattle, and Rick had homed on every one of them, weeping and shrinking before my very eyes, until all that was left of Rick was what he owned of Pym, and all that was left of Pym, it seemed to me, as I wove my lies and blandished, and perjured myself before one kangaroo court after another, was a failing con man, tottering on the last legs of his credibility. And that's how it was, Tom. Betrayal is a repetitious trade, and I will not bother you with more of it. We have reached the end, though it seems from here to look quite like the beginning. The firm pulled Pym out of Washington and sent him to Vienna, so that he could take back his networks, and so that his growing army of accusers could draw its wretched computer pattern tighter round his neck. There was no saving him, not in the end. Poppy knew that. So did Pym, though he would never admit it, even to himself. "Just one more con," Pym kept saying to himself. "One more con will see me right." Poppy pressed him, begged him, threatened him. Pym was adamant. "Leave me in peace. I'll win through. They love me. I've given my life to them." But the truth is, Tom, that Pym preferred to test the limits of the tolerance of those he loved. He preferred to sit here in Miss Dubber's upper room and wait for God to come, while he looked down the gardens to the beach, where the best pals ever had kicked a football from one end of the world to the other, and ridden their Harrods bicycles across the sea. Chapter 18. It's fireworks night at Plush, thought Mary, staring into the darkness of the square. It's an unlit bonfire waiting for Tom. Through the windscreen of their parked car, she gazed at the empty bandstand and pretended she saw the last of her family and retainers crammed into the old cricket pavilion. The muffled footsteps were the footsteps of the gamekeepers as they gathered to her brother Sam, back for his last leave. She pretended she could hear her brother's voice, a little too parade ground for her liking, still scratchy from the strain of Ireland.
Tom, he calls. Where's old Tom?
Not a move. Tom is stuck inside Mary's sheepskin coat, his head jammed against her thigh, and nothing short of Christmas is going to lure him out.
Come on, Tom Pym, you're the youngest, cries Sam. Where is he? You'll be too old next year, you know, Tom.
Then his brutal dismissal.
Fuck it, let's have someone else.
Tom is shamed, the Pyms are disgraced. Sam, as usual, is angry that Tom has no taste for blowing up the universe. A braver child puts the match, and the world ignites. Her brother's military rockets race over it in perfect salvos. Everyone is small, looking at the night sky. She sat at Brotherhood's side, and he was holding her wrist, the way the doctor held it when she was about to bear her little coward. To reassure her, to steady her, to say, I am in charge here. The car was parked in a side street, and behind them stood the police van. And behind the police van stood a caravan of about 600 parked police cars, and radio vans, and ambulances, and bomb lorries. All occupied by Sam's familiars, who spoke soundlessly to one another without moving their eyes. Beside her was a shop called Sugar Novelties, with a neon-lit window and a plastic gnome pushing a wheelbarrow laden with dusty sweets. And next to it, a granite workhouse, with public library engraved over a funereal door. Across the street stood a hideous Baptist church that told you God was no fun either. Beyond the church lay God's square and his bandstand and his monkey puzzle trees. And between the fourth and fifth tree from the left, as she had counted 20 times, and three quarters of the way up, hung an arched, lighted window with the orange curtains drawn, which my officers advise me is where your husband's room is situated, madam, though our inquiries indicate that he is known locally by the name of Canterbury, and is well liked in the community. He's always liked, Mary snapped. But the superintendent was saying this to Brotherhood. He was speaking through Brotherhood's window, and deferring to Brotherhood as her keeper. And Mary knew that the superintendent had been ordered to speak to her as little as possible, which came hard to him. And that Brotherhood had given himself the job of answering for her, which the superintendent seemed to accept was as near to godliness as he was likely to get without having his ears blasted off. The superintendent was a Devon man, family and ponderously traditional. I'm so frightfully glad he's being arrested by a Devon man, Mary thought cruelly, in Caroline Lumsden's Sloan Ranger Twitter. I always think it's so much nicer to be taken prisoner by a man of the soil.
Are you quite sure you wouldn't like to come into the church hall, madam?
The superintendent was saying for the 100th time.
It's much warmer in the church hall, and there's some quite fine company. Cosmopolitan, counting the Americans.
She's best here, Brotherhood murmured in reply.
Only we can't allow the gentleman to switch on the engine, you see, to be truthful, madam. And if he can't switch on the engine, well, you can't have the heat in, if you see what I mean.
I'd like you to go away, Mary said. She's all right as she is, said Brotherhood.
Only it could be all night, you see, madam. Could be all tomorrow, too, if our friend decides to stick it out, kind of thing, to be truthful.
We'll play it as it comes, Brotherhood said. When you need her, this is where she'll be.
Well, I'm afraid she won't, sir, to be truthful, not when we go in, if we have to. I'm afraid she'll have to withdraw to a somewhat safer position, to be truthful, same as you. Only the rest of them are back in the church hall, if you follow me, sir, and the chief constable says that's where all non-combatants have got to be at that stage in the proceedings, including the Americans.
She doesn't want to be with the rest of them, said Mary, before Brotherhood could speak. And she's not American. She's his wife. The superintendent went away and came back almost immediately. He's the go-between. They've chosen him for his bedside manner. Message from the roof, sir, he began apologetically, crouching yet again to Brotherhood's window. Do you happen to know, please, the precise type and calibre of the weapon our friend is alleged to have in his possession?
Standard Browning .38 automatic. An old one. Shouldn't think it's been cleaned for years.
Any theories regarding the type of ammunition at all, sir? Only it would be nice for them to know the carry, you see.
Short nose, I should think. But not a stopper, for instance, or a dum-dum. Why the hell should he want a dum-dum?
I don't know, sir, do I? Information is gold dust on this one, the way it's being passed around, if I may say so. I haven't seen so many tight lips in one room for, oh, a long time. How many rounds has our friend got, do you think?
One magazine, maybe a spare.
Mary was suddenly furious.
For God's sake, he's not a maniac. He's not going to start a...
Start a what?
Said the superintendent, whose country manners had a way of slipping when he wasn't spoken to respectfully.
Just assume it's one magazine and one spare, Brotherhood said.
Well then, perhaps you can tell us how our friend's marksmanship is,
the superintendent suggested, as if stepping onto safer ground.
You can't blame them for asking that, can you? He's been trained and topped up all his life, said Brotherhood.
He's good, said Mary.
Now, how do you know that, madam, if I may be allowed to ask a simple question?
He shoots Tom's air pistol with him.
Rats and that, or something larger?
Paper targets.
Does he now, and gets a high score then, does he, madam?
Tom says so. She glanced at Brotherhood, and knew what he was thinking.
Just let me go in and get him, gun or no.
She was thinking much the same herself.
Magnus, come out of there and stop making yourself so bloody ridiculous.
The superintendent was speaking again, this time to Brotherhood directly.
Now there's a query from our disposal people this time, sir, he said, as if it were all a little bit unreasonable, but we must humour them. Regarding this box device our friend is carrying with him, I've tried them in the church hall, but they're all a bit above the technicalities, like, and they said to ask you. Our boys do appreciate they're not allowed to know too much about it, but they would like the benefit of your wisdom regarding the charge it contains.
It's self-consuming, Brotherhood replied. It's not a weapon.
Ah, but could it be used as a weapon, put it that way, if it got into the hands of one who might, for instance, have lost the balance of his mind?
Not unless he puts somebody inside it, Brotherhood replied, and the superintendent let out a mellow country laugh.
I'll tell that one to the boys, he promised. They like a joke up there, the boys do. It gets the tension out of them.
His voice fell, and he spoke to Brotherhood alone.
Has our friend ever fired his gun in anger, sir?
It's not his gun.
Ah, now you didn't quite answer the question there, sir, did you?
To my knowledge, he's never been in a shootout.
Our friend doesn't get angry, Mary said.
Has he ever taken anybody prisoner, sir?
Us, Mary said.
Pym had made the cocoa, and Pym had put the new shawl over Miss Dubber's shoulders, although she said she didn't feel the chill. Pym had chopped up the piece of chicken for Toby that he had bought at the supermarket as a treat for him. And if she had let him, he would have cleaned out the canary's cage as well. For the canary was his secret pride, ever since a night when he had found it dead after Miss Dubber had gone to bed, and contrived unknown to her to exchange it for a live one with Mr. Loring of the pet shop. But Miss Dubber wanted no more fussing from him. She wanted him sitting beside her where she could keep an eye on him, and listen to him reading Aunt Al's latest letter from distant Sri Lanka, which came in yesterday, Mr. Canterbury, but you never had the interest.
"Is that Ali the Dobie who stole her lace last year?" she inquired sharply, interrupting him. "Why does she go on employing him if he stole from her? I thought we'd seen the last of Ali long ago."
"I expect she forgave him," said Pym. "He had all those wives, if you remember. She probably couldn't bear to chuck him into the street."
His voice was very clear to him and beautiful. It was good to speak aloud.
"I do wish she'd come home," Miss Dubber said.
It can't be good for her, the heat, after all these years.
Ah, but then she'd have to do her own washing, wouldn't she, Miss D? Said Pym. And his smile warmed him, as he knew it was warming her.
You're better now, aren't you, Mr. Canterbury? I'm so glad. It's got out of you, whatever it is. You can have a nice rest now.
From what? Said Pym, gently, still smiling for her.
Whatever you've been doing all these years. You can let somebody else run the country for a while. Did he leave you a lot of work to do, the poor gentleman who died?
I suppose he did, really. It's always difficult when you don't have a proper handover.
But you'll be all right now, won't you? I can see.
I will when you say you'll take that holiday, Miss D.
Only if you come.
I can't do that. I told you, I run out of leave. His voice had lifted more than he intended. She looked at him, and he saw the scare in her face, which was how he had caught her looking at him ever since the Green Cabinet had arrived, or when he had smiled and pampered her too much.
Well, I'm not going, she replied tartly. I don't like putting Toby into prison, and Toby doesn't like going to prison. And we're not going to do it just to please you, are we, Toby? You're very kind, but don't mention it again. Is that all, she says?
The rest is about the race riots. She thinks there are more on the way. I didn't think you'd like it.
You're quite right, I would not, said Miss Dubber firmly,
and her eyes stayed on him as he crossed the room, folded the letter, and put it in the ginger jar.
You can read it to me in the morning when I don't mind so much. Why is the square quiet? Why isn't Mrs. Peel playing her television next door? She should be watching that announcer she's in love with.
Probably gone to bed, said Pym. More cocoa, Miss D, he asked, taking the mugs to the scullery. The curtains were drawn, but beside the window was an extractor fan, which Pym had built into the wooden wall, and it was made of transparent plastic. Putting his eye to it, he quickly surveyed the square, but saw no sign of life.
Don't be silly, Mr. Canterbury, Miss Double was saying. You know I never have a second cup. Come back and watch the news.
At the far end of the square, in the shadow of the church, a small light went on and off.
Not tonight, Miss D, if you don't mind, he called to her. I've had nothing but politics all week.
He ran the tap and waited till the Crimean War geezer caught before he rinsed the mugs.
I'm going to put myself to bed and give the world a rest, Miss D. Well, you'd better answer the telephone first, she replied. It's for you.
She must have lifted the receiver at once, for he had not heard it above the sobbing of the geezer. It had never rung for him before. He returned to the kitchen, and she was holding out the receiver to him, and he saw the scare in her face again, accusing him, as he reached out a steady hand to take it. He put the phone to his ear and said,
Canterbury?
The line went dead. But he kept the phone to his ear and gave a quick, bright smile of recognition to the middle distance of Miss Dubber's kitchen, somewhere between the picture of Pilgrim slogging up the hill past the hookers and the picture of the little girl in bed with her hair brushed, about to eat her boiled egg.
Thank you, he said. Well, thank you very much indeed, Bill.
Well, that's very handsome of you, and of the minister.
Thank him for me, will you, Bill? Let's have lunch about it next week.
On me. He rang off. There was a lot of heat in his face, and he was no longer quite sure, now that he looked at Miss Dubber, what her expression was doing, or whether she was aware of the pains he was getting around the shoulders and neck and in the right knee, which he had ricked when he was skiing at Lech with Tom.
Apparently the minister's rather pleased with the work I did for him, he explained to her, a little blindly. He wanted me to know that my efforts hadn't been in vain. That was his private secretary, Bill, but Sir William Wells, friend of mine.
I see, Miss Dubber said, but she was not enthusiastic. The minister's not terribly appreciative as a rule, to be honest. Doesn't let it show. Hard man to please. Practically never been known to hand out a compliment in his life, but we're all rather devoted to him. Warts and all, as you might say. We do all rather tend to be a bit fond of him, notwithstanding, if you follow. We've all rather decided to accept that he's part of life's rich pageant and not some sort of monster.
Yes, well,
I'm tired, Misty.
Let's put you to bed. She had not moved. He talked harder. It wasn't himself, of course. He's in all-night session, liable to be there on and off for a long while. This was his private secretary.
So you told me.
That's medal material, Pym, dear boy, he said. The old man actually smiled. The old man, that's what we call the minister. Sir William to his face, but the old man behind his back. Be nice to have a gong, wouldn't it, Misty? Put it over the fireplace. Polish it at Easter and Christmas. Our own private medal. Earned on the premises. If anyone's deserved it, you have. He stopped speaking for a while because he was blurting a bit and his mouth was dry, and he had the worst ear and throat thing he could remember. I really ought to go to one of those private health clinics and have the complete sheep dip. So instead of speaking, he stood over her with his hands dangling so that he could haul her to her feet and give her the old goodnight bear hug that meant so much to her. But Miss Dubba did not oblige. She did not want the hug.
"Why you call yourself Canterbury if your name is Pym?" she demanded sternly.
"That's my first name, Pym, like Pip, Pym Canterbury." She thought for a long time about that. She studied his dried-up eyes and his cheek muscles that were writhing for no known reason. And he noticed that she didn't like much what she saw and was disposed to quarrel. But as he strained his smile at her and willed her with all the life that was left in him, he was rewarded by a strict nod of acceptance.
"Well, we're both too old for Christian names now, Mr. Canterbury," she said. After which she did finally hold out her arms, and he did gently take hold of them above the elbows. And he did have to remember not to pull too hard, because he was so keen to have her against him, and get himself off to bed where he belonged.
"Now I'm glad about that medal," she announced, as he led her along the passage. "I've always admired a man who gets a medal, Mr. Canterbury, whatever he's done."
The stairs belonged to the houses of his childhood, so he skipped up them lightly and forgot his aches and pains. The Star of Bethlehem lampshade on the landing, though it shed a lousy light, was an old friend from the Glades. "Everything is kind to me," he noticed. When he pushed open the door of his room, everything winked and laughed at him like a surprise party. The parcels were all as he had prepared them, but it never did any harm to check, so he checked them now. Envelope for Miss Dubber. Lots of money and apologies. Envelope to Jack. No money, and come to think of it, precious few apologies. Poppy. How odd that you are such a distant sound at last. That stupid filing cabinet. I don't know why I bothered with it all these years. I haven't even looked inside. The burn box. What a weight it is for so few secrets. Nothing to Mary, but he'd really nothing much more to say to her. Sorry I married you for cover. Glad I managed a bit of love along the way. Hazards of the trade, my dear. You're a spy too, remember? Rather better than Pym was, come to think of it. Class will tell in the end. Only the envelope to Tom bothered him, and he tore open the sealed flap, feeling that a last word of explanation was, after all, required. "You see, Tom, I am the bridge," he wrote, in a hand that was irritatingly sluggish. "I am what you must walk over to get from Rick to life." Then he added his initials, as one always should with a postscript, and addressed a fresh envelope, and put the old one in the waste paper basket, because he had been taught from early in his life that untidiness was the sister of insecurity. Then he hauled the burn box from the top of the cabinet to the desk, and with the two keys from his chain, disarmed it, and fished out first the files, which were too secret to be classified at all, and which gave a lot of bogus information about the networks he and Poppy had so painstakingly composed. He chucked them in the waste paper basket too. When he'd done that, he pulled out the gun, and loaded it, and cocked it, all rather swiftly, and set it on the desk, thinking of the many times he had carried a gun and not fired it. He heard a scraping sound from the roof and said to himself, "Must be a cat." He shook his head as if to say, "Those damned cats, they get everywhere these days. Don't give the birds a chance."
He glanced at his gold watch. A wide gesture, remembering that Rick had given it to him, and that he might forget to take it off in the bath. So he took it off now, and laid it on Tom's envelope, and drew a cheerful moon face right next to it, the sign they drew for one another to say smile. He undressed and laid his clothes neatly by the bed. Then he put on his dressing gown and took both his towels from the clothes horse, the big one for the bath, the small one for hands and face. He slipped the gun into the dressing gown pocket, leaving the safety catch in the off position. Because it was the laborious ethic of the trainers that a safed gun was more dangerous than a live one. He was only going across the corridor, but it's a violent world these days, and you can't be too careful. About to open the bathroom door, he was annoyed to discover that the porcelain knob had stiffened up and scarcely turned. Damn doorknob. Look at that. It took him all the strength of both his hands to twist it, and, more annoying still, some idiot must have left soap on it, because his hands kept slithering, and he had to use a towel to get a grip. It's probably dear old Lipsy, he thought with a smile, always living in that world inside her head. Placing himself for the last time before the shaving mirror, he arranged the towels around his head and shoulders, making a bonnet of the smaller one and a cape of the larger one. For if there was one thing Miss Dubber hated above another, it was mess. Then he held the gun to where his right ear was, forgetting, as anybody might in the circumstances, whether the trigger of your Browning .38 automatic had two pressures or just the one. And he noticed how he was leaning, not away from the gun, but into it, like somebody who is a little deaf, straining for a sound. Mary never heard the shot. The superintendent was crouching at Brotherhood's window again, this time to tell him that Magnus's presence inside the house had now been positively confirmed by a ruse, and that he had orders to assemble non-combatants in the church hall without delay. Brotherhood was contesting this, and Mary still had her eye on the four men playing Granny's footsteps among the chimney pots across the square. For half an hour now they had been reeling out rope to one another and adopting classic postures of stealth, and Mary loathed the lot of them more than she could have imagined possible. A society that admires its shock troops had better be bloody careful about where it's going, Magnus liked to say. The superintendent was confirming that there were no other male lodgers on the premises, apart from the said Canterbury, and he was asking Mary whether she would hold herself in readiness to speak to her husband on the telephone, in a conciliatory manner, if this became necessary during the course of operations. And Mary was retorting, "Of course I will," in an overbold whisper, intended to deflate all this theatrical nonsense. All those things in her later memory were taking place, or had just done so, as Brotherhood shoved open the driver's door, sending the superintendent flying to one side, one boot forever frozen in the window frame. After that, she had a forward image of Jack pelting towards the house at a young man's pace, because sometimes she had a dream of him doing exactly that, and the house was always plush, and he was coming to make love to her. But with the clamour all around him, he was standing still. Lights had come on. Ambulances were racing to the spot without apparently knowing where the spot was. Police and plainclothes men were falling over each other, and the fools on the roof were shouting at the fools in the square, and England was being saved from things it didn't know were threatening it. But Jack Brotherhood was standing to attention, like a dead centurion at his post, and everyone was watching a dignified little lady in a dressing gown, coming down the steps of her house.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of A Perfect Spy by John le Carré. This program was produced by Audio Go Limited. A Perfect Spy is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2012. All rights reserved. The book, A Perfect Spy, is available wherever Penguin books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.